It's going to be like a 4.5 hour episode.
Nah, we'll go. John goes fast, and I don't have that much to say about anything except for Sal Gow.
Okay.
It's pronounced Sal Gow.
Wake me up before you Sal Go.
Oh my God. Stop it.
Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today is Duncan.
Hello.
Jeff.
Hello.
And John.
Hi.
This week is a big week because we are celebrating both the end of the winter season of anime and the beginning of the spring season of anime.
We're taking all the shows from last season, putting them in a Wicker Man and burning them.
Yeah. Excellent synopsis. I know that a couple, that Duncan and I actually had a pretty close overlap, that we both watched the second season of March Comes in Like a Lion, which ended excellently. I know Andy's got a lot of thoughts too, so maybe we'll come back to that later. Did you have any feelings, Duncan, or was it just good?
I think that's arguably the show where Shaft, as a production studio, proves it can do something a bit less flippant and a bit more serious than it's previously been thought of, doing this very sincere, very emotional drama for 3 seasons, generally being excellent throughout.
Yeah, and having a very wide emotional range between crushing tragedy and depression to lighthearted, goofy hijinks about old men who just hang out at the shogi hall and make jokes about each other.
Do you think they've matured, or do you think that as a studio, their key staff have maybe grown out of what they became famous for and are now starting to want more serious subject matter?
Well, I mean, I do wonder, because by now, even though Shinbo is technically director for everything that comes out of Shaft, he is chief director, and there is usually a guy under him who is actually directing the show. March Comes in Like a Lion is actually, I'm making air quotes, directed by Okada Kenjiro, who came up mostly through the Monogatari series, although he also directed episodes on Senseki Yori, Tonari no Seki-kun, Suritama, and he did tweening on Kimi ni Todoke. So, like, he's seems to have kind of spent a lot of time outside of the studio before coming in to work on Monogatari. But yeah, I do think there's a maturation. And actually, to go ahead and violate my own schedule of discussion, I've been watching Nisekoi, False Love, which is a Shaft production from 2014. And that one actually, despite being kind of a fairly bog standard harem, mistaken identities, rom-com, also actually shows a lot of maturity. So I do think that the show is growing up. And I actually think that probably the runaway success of the Madoka movies and the Monogatari series has allowed them to have the money to make shows that are more subtle. Because, like, Nisekoi is, it's got a lot of, like, two people have to pretend to be in love because they're both children of the leaders of rival gangs. But he's in love with someone else, and then someone else comes in who he had a childhood promise with, because anime is all about them, childhood promises. But it's actually kind of mature in the fact that, like, there'll be times when he, like, so the underling, or, like, the chief bodyguard of the girl that the main dude's in love with hates him because he thinks he's faking the relationship, which he is. That's the main dramatic tension. They go to a hot springs, their entire school, and he, like, switches the signs so that he goes into the girl hot springs. And the girl that he's, like, pretending to be in love with, who he actually hates because he thinks she's, like, unmannerly and gangly and loud because she's half American, catches him. And she's like, what the? And then she's like, oh, Claude switched the signs, didn't he? And he's like, yeah, I'm glad you understand. And this happens a lot in Nisekoi, and it's actually what's keeping me going, is that they keep having, like, he, like, gets caught with the key to the girl's locker room because he's trying to find a key to this, like, weird demonic locket that his childhood promise friend gave him. And she's like, you have the key to the girl's locker room. Oh, you're looking for the key to your locket. And he's like, yeah, I'm glad you understand. And this happens a lot. And it's actually, it's funny because it keeps blueballing the people that want the really bad, like, love Hina sort of comical misunderstanding where he gets the shit beaten out of him. And often he does still get the shit beaten out of him. But it is kind of just, like, more mature. And it's someone who's been around the block and seen all the anime and wants to make something different. And I think that also speaks to, like, March Comes in Like a Lion, where we could have something that's a lot more like Honey and Clover or I don't know, maybe something that's more sports focused or more caught up in like being a sad sack fest, but actually has a very large range and is very content to constantly violate viewer expectations.
I'm struggling to think off the top of my head of a better long form drama, anime full stop. I think it's just set a very high standard now, which both for them and just company as a whole, I can't think of many which...
Rakugo.
That's cheating. You're appealing to Duncan's soft inner core.
I don't think Rakugo is as good as March Comes In Like Lion, but it's still pretty good.
Hmm.
I feel like there's also... We have to be careful, at least for me, I have to be careful, because the longer something runs, the more I kind of just smooth over the things that are weird or bad about it and kind of just like existing.
I honestly think it got stronger.
Yes, I do think it got stronger. The second season... The Rookie King guy and like the episode about him and the absolutely heart-destroying Burned Field arc about the like 80-year-old chess master and how like everybody he knows who is in this hobby has quit this hobby. And so he feels like if he quits, he's letting all of them down because they've got this great image. I think I talked about this in the last podcast. And if I did, I'm sorry. Like he has the image of all their competitors' banners, like tying him up like a mummy or tying him down like a... Like a prisoner. And
it's like someone covered in seaweed almost. He's just got all this stuff wrapped around him and he's struggling forward through it under its weight.
The thing is, if I were to compare this to other stuff, I would compare it to my two favorite sports anime, which are Chihiafuru and Cross Game, both of which are a lot more sports focused than March Comes In Like a Lion, which has a lot of insider weeb chess, as the dear departed Andy would describe it. But... It also, like, there's that long section about bullying, and you get to, the way that they, at least a couple of the reviewers I've read describe March Comes In Like a Lion, is everyone gets to have an inner life. Everyone has a problem that makes them complicated and interesting. And you can do that when you have 44 episodes, and the simple fact is almost nothing gets more than two core these days.
Mm.
And so the fact that it can, except for like Black Clover or something.
So it's basically you give a talented studio a lot of money and a lot of time to make a series. They, strangely enough, make a good one.
Yeah. And let them have like weak episodes and arcs that go nowhere. Because it's funny to read the early reviews where they're like, man, they're focusing a lot on this family of girls. And like, isn't this story about Rey? And then people come around like, oh, no, it's about like everybody. It's about an ecosystem, a community. Those are the anime where I feel the most comfortable and cozy, when you're just like living in a place and everybody's interesting and you're never like, oh no. I mean, it's not like for me reading the Game of Thrones books being, oh God, a Cersei chapter. Okay. I can wait this out. But no, like I'm never like, oh no, it's a Hina chapter. Oh no, it's a, what's his name? The fat kid who's Rey's friend. Nikaido. Yes. No, it's all great. Even like the teacher, who's honestly probably my least favorite character of like the main cast.
Duh, just a hater.
No, it's a great show. The only thing that holds me back from recommending it is that it's 44 episodes. But I mean, this is the age of streaming and binging. So you can do it. And I believe in you, people.
I have a question.
Yes.
About Nisekoi.
Yeah.
Why do people not like it? Because every time I've asked multiple times, is Nisekoi worth watching? And they always say no. And you said that before I watched it too, because I know that you probably heard the same thing that I heard. So why don't people like it?
People don't like it because it is smart in a weird way, but at the same time, it also is an endless tease. There are no consequences. The show is very good at not moving forward. And in fact, anytime any progress starts to happen, they either have like a baseball fly through a classroom window as a confession is happening, or they introduce a new character who complicates the dynamic and keeps the main character Raku from deciding to pursue the girl he likes, who's quiet and sweet, the girl he hates, who's loud and rude, but of course in classic anime fashion is slowly falling in love with, the sickly ladylike girl who's actually like super rude and mean, and is you watch Steiner's Etsuba Sensei, so you know like the like secretly mean one who like sticks chopsticks up dog butts. That's like her secret personality, is she's like actually like a huge asshole, and she's the best character. So no, that's not true. The best character is cross-dressing girl who dresses as a boy and was raised as a boy and like discovers unseemly ladylike feelings when meeting Raku. And that's the, I mean, it's a harem that knows it's a harem. And if you are just fine with that, it's enjoyable. But if you want like people to progress and develop their relationships at any faster rate than the bare minimum moving forward rate of anime harem stories, it's very funny, but it goes nowhere. And I'm 16 episodes in and they just keep introducing characters. And like in the fourth episode, literally three different people told him like, oh yeah, Anundera, she likes you. Yeah, everyone knows she likes you. So just like confess to her. And he's like, no, we're just good friends. And then Anundera's best friend, who's awesome, Ruri Miyamoto, who when Anundera finds out that what's his name, Raku, is dating the like annoying half-American girl, Chitage, she's like, go after him anyway. He may not like her that much. He might want to date you instead, which is exactly what the case is. And there's a great thing where they're on a bus trip and they sit three to a seat, and she like keeps, every time there's a turn, she's like, oh no, I'm falling over. And she just keeps pushing her into him, and they're both like, stop that. And she's like, I'm sorry, I can't control it. No, she's the best and I want a show about her. But apparently she becomes mushy and falls in love too. It's just,
what?
So the harem that sounds like, that knows it's a harem, is kind of how you also describe Saikano. Is it like I'm avoiding the pitfalls of that show?
Saikano is very meta and genre savvy in that it literally makes reference to the different like dynamics that they're setting up. While Nisekoi is kind of just like the consummate athlete who knows that he's running a race, and he or she is running a race, and that they can take whatever pace they want and do whatever they want because they know they'll win it. So it's a lot less self-conscious. It's more just like, because I know the stakes, and this is Shaft in its money-rich, talent-rich form, and it can just kind of make the most crowd-pleasingest, enjoyable, but still kind of generic and frustrating harem anime it wants to make. I'm having a fine time. If I wanted to see two teenagers hook up and fall in love, I would be incredibly pissed at the show. But I think the jokes, like, it makes me laugh a lot, which is not, hasn't been the case for harem anime in a long time. I mean, I guess Saikano did a little bit, but Saikano also made me, like, scream with fury. But it also is just, like, the four women who are in love with him are all, like, very stock dairy types of, you know, where they have the tsundere, koidere, dandere, yandere mix. It's hitting all the corners, and it's kind of a tease. It's not kind of a tease. It's a consummate tease, and there's no development, and there's no consequences for things that happen, because everybody seems to be in on the secret that that they need to make this last for 36 episodes. So,
all right,
I'm enjoying it, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. I don't know. I like Shaft, and I mean, I know that Duncan, you've been actually also watching a lesser Shaft.
Yeah, and another sort of harem high school as well. Although this is more of a failed attempt at creating a harem than an actual successful one.
This is Maria Holic, which is different from XXX Holic, which are the two I always mix up.
Yeah.
Somewhat different. Maria Holic is, I think, best thought of as the entire female cast of Sayonara Zetsubou Sensei transplanted to a Catholic girls' school and taking part in a gone wrong mix of Yuri, harems, and cross-dressing.
Is it good? Is it bad? Is it fine?
It's good, but it shouldn't be.
Sounds like Shaft.
It's weird because the central sort of butt of all the jokes, Kaneko, is just like almost like an inverse Zetsubou. She's just always failing, but she's just incredibly optimistic and just doesn't care. She has this like dream of getting her own little Yuri harem at high school, and she's determined to fulfill it no matter what, and she just throws herself wholeheartedly into it. And the show seems to be at the same time both cheering her on and laughing at her, which sometimes leaves a bit of a bad taste in the mouth, but sometimes it works. It's I think it's dated, doesn't have what I would describe as the best attitude to people who are not heteronormative, both in its treatment of its cross-dressing and lesbian characters. Having said that, the cross-dressing Maria, who's the titular character, is one of the most likable characters in it. And Kaneko, the lesbian, is the second most likable character, and they're very likable, but they're very broadly drawn. I think I maybe give it a bit more license because it was made a few years back, but...
Yeah, 2009, yeah.
It's weird because in some ways there's a best described as slightly S&M dynamic between Maria and Kaneko. And it reminds me a bit of some stuff in Lady Killer in a Bind, which is weird because that is a very recent and far more polar opposite, in fact, in terms of how well it deals with modern sexual identity.
And yet it would not surprise me whatsoever if Christine Love had watched Rhea Hollick.
Mm. I don't know, I have very, very mixed feelings about it. I laugh at it, but I sort of wonder if I'm giving it a more generous read than it deserves in the way it treats its characters at times. And this does have great OPs and EDs as well, though. But that's sort of almost par for the course for any Shaft show.
Yeah, yeah. It's also got great talent. Like, is it Kaneko, you said, is the main...
Yeah.
Main girl? Like, she voiced Matoi, the stalker girl on Signers Zetsubou Sensei, and the teacher on Kaon, Sawako, who's one of my favorite anime characters of all time, so...
Yeah, I mean, as far as I could tell, I don't think any of the girls are not one of the girls from Zetsubou Sensei, and that had a great cast.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, it transfers well to this.
No, yeah, I'm looking at it, but I'm not going to do the thing that I always want to do of just, like, reading off all the things that they've done. That's cool. I mean, I've wanted to go back and look at more Shaft stuff because I think the early stuff is weird and interesting. I know that I was so enthusiastic about Natsuno Arashi that I talked John into watching it, and he kind of confirmed my opinion. Not much, but he enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good show.
Yeah, and like also like Sorimachi.
That's a great show.
And Yet the Town Moves is also great. And yeah, like Minor Shaft is almost the better Shaft, I say to someone who has just watched all of the Monogatari series like 5 times. Don't mean to call you out, Jeff. I haven't watched a Shaft show that's disappointed me except for Madoka. And that's more because I hate Madoka fans than I dislike the show. Also, the art's ugly, so...
It is so ugly.
I mean, dang it, I might watch that after Nisekoi. No, I need to like watch actual anime, not just continue to wallow in the mud that is Shaft Productions. Let's keep going through last season.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sounds good.
I had a great transition before John got me off on talking about like why Nisekoi is bad. And it's bad just because it's formulaic. It's smart, but formulaic. It's the kid who could write a good essay, but he writes the like standard essay because he knows it'll get an A anyway. That's the problem with Nisekoi. Before that, I was going to say, speaking of surprisingly affecting dramas, I know that Duncan, you and I were really into After the Rain, which we talked about a lot, and we only really need to touch on the ending, which was unfortunately a bit rushed because it's a it's an anime original ending, but I thought it was fine.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that sells it a bit short. I mean, there were a couple of shows last season where I felt could have ended an episode earlier and I wouldn't have been bothered. And I felt like in many ways After the Rain had its sort of main emotional high points in the couple of episodes preceding. And that final one was right. We just got to cross the T's, dot the I's, and just get everything in shape.
Yeah, have a long magic hug between the 45-year-old manager and the 17-year-old girl where they're both like, okay, we're gonna go back to our lives. This has been a nice, weird vacation, but now it's like, you're going to pursue running, I'm going to get back into writing, and we'll go back to our lives. And that's like kind of the nice thing. Oftentimes, I feel in anime and fiction in general, love is seen as a all-consuming thing where it's you're either committed to it or being tortured by it. And I like the idea of love and affection as kind of a splint or a cast that helps you heal from other stuff that's going bad in your life. And once you're done, you can just leave it behind. You don't need to have a sexual relationship with your manager who's three times your age. You really don't.
Yeah, one of those immortal lessons that everyone has to go through at some point in their life.
But no, I do think that there is. I mean, I'll hand it over to you, Duncan, in a second. But I do think you're right that the second to last episode is like people making the choice to push past their pain, largely because they recognize that it doesn't go away.
Hmm.
It doesn't go away unless you hide from everyone you care about. Like, Kondo has to hide from his rider friend, and Tachibana has to hide from her running friend to be okay. And so, like, you're hurting yourself by trying to avoid pain. And the last episode was kind of just like, yep, this is a healing trajectory. Things are going to get better for them, which is nice.
I mean, that's a good summation. We might well do well to leave it there.
Cool. Well, going into the trash that I watched last season, Takunomi, the show about girls who live together and drink. Fine.
Boring.
Fine. It was mediocre Wakakozake. So, like, if you have watched Wakakozake and you're like, man, I want to watch another show where, like, people drink and then they tell you what food tastes good with the drink. Yeah, that's it.
I would not recommend it, but that's me.
It's kind of boring, but I'm fine. Degashikashi,
yeah.
It was good. I mean, I kind of resented that we only got Hajime Owari for like three episodes of full comedy, and we're probably not going to get another season after this because it did not do well. So
did it need to do as well being half length?
You still need to sell the disc. I mean, in fact, you need to sell more discs because presumably there's more episodes per disc. So yeah, I thought it was great, but I think people were tired of Degashikashi and did not really, really want a second season deep down. So
when me and Duncan talked about it, I think it was literally the week before they introduced Hajime Owari. And we had both said that it's, you know, it's the show that doesn't really have a, you know, a meta plot, and it benefits from being short. And then the week after, it introduced this new character and this new drama with the convenience store opening up across the way. And all of a sudden I was invested emotionally in this show that before it was just this like junk food trash that and yeah, I was really bummed that we only got like, you know, six half episodes of this decent sort of slice of life, sort of Bildungsroman.
Bildungsroman. Just run through it really fast.
Yeah.
And yeah, I feel you too. Like, I think we talked about this in the last non-tween episode, but it got really real near the end where they're going to have a party for him. And she's like, actually, no, he's going to come back. He's going to be really bummed. And like, that sort of hidden depth is why I like consume fiction, is like walking past a puddle and seeing like a weird angle of light that shows that like, oh wow, this is way deeper than I thought it was. And that like line from Hajime, who knows a lot of manga stuff and like encourages him to try stuff, but then also knows that this is going to be like a crushing moment that defines his life in one way or another.
Yeah, just to contextualize that, to say another thing quickly, the main character Coconuts, when you're first introduced to him, is an aspiring mangaka, and as the show progresses, he gets more and more invested in taking care of the shop, which is also kind of an extension of his romantic feelings towards Hotaru, who disappears. And then when Hajime Owari comes back in, she encourages him to pursue his manga dream again, and he finds out that there's going to be a professional editor in the next town over looking at stuff. And so he, you know, does this big push with all of his friends helping him, and then he's gonna go do it. And like, and in any other show, it would be, this is his big moment and he is going to ascend. But instead they play it way more realistically, where it's like, you know, this is a kid who rushed this in the last minute, and there's no way in hell that this is actually going to work out for him, and he's actually going to have to work a lot harder for it. And the show deals with that, you know, in a pretty sweet way, you know, for a show that is, you know, relatively shallow, mostly
about candy.
Yeah. And it was good. It was really good.
I think we're actually completely retracing our old conversation, but it was without you, Jeff. But no, like the way that the editor knows immediately, like, you did this in the past 2 weeks, probably in the past 2 days. And he's like, you lack focus. I mean, at least you're young. You can improve. And it's just like, oh, that is exactly like why I never like let anyone read the novels I tried to read when I was 15 or 16. Is because like, you don't want to hear that feedback as a kid, because you want it to be that magical fantasy that he has of like, oh, this is actually the best thing I've ever read. because you don't have taste. You don't know, like, what good manga is, and you don't know the work that goes behind it, so.
Yeah, it's, like, the entirety of Blue Blazes in, like...
We should have a Blue Blazes tween.
Yeah, let's do that.
I have Blue Blazes feelings. John should watch it.
One day.
It's really good. It's really funny in a weird way.
It's actually what got me back into watching anime after, like, a good 5-6 year lapse.
And sadly, because J-dramas don't get licensed in the U.S., there'll never be a legal official way to watch it. So,
yeah.
Sorry, everybody. Maybe once the singularity happens. And the last thing is Aggressive Retsuko ended after 100 episodes, because there's going to be a Netflix series. And it was had actually kind of had kind of a depressing ending, where she had, like, the worst day in the world, and she went to a karaoke room, and then she got kicked out, and she's like, not enough time, and then that's the end of the show. Aggressive Retsuko is... It's actually, compared to March Comes in the Line, it's easy to recommend. It's 100 episodes, but they're 2 minutes each. So that's 200 minutes. That's what, like...
3 hours.
A little over 3 hours of... And they're all almost all funny. And when they aren't funny, they're real. So yeah, watch Aggressive Retsuko. Having a cute red panda be stressed about the same shit that you're stressed about at work is very gratifying. So, or the same crappy friends who, like, insult themselves looking for compliments. And you're like...
Oh, that's me.
Speaking of you, John, you also watched a few, including, I think, some of the more popular shows of the season, like Ice Girls and Camp Girls and Time People.
Time People. Yeah.
Okay, if there's one thing that doesn't happen in that show is time travel. Like,
yeah, there's no time travel. It's just time stopped.
Isn't stopping time a sort of travel?
No,
it's the opposite.
Yeah, it's literally seizing the traveling.
You guys do not have your Zen principles down pat.
No, I don't. Speaking of time, that would be Kokoku, which was a show that was great. I liked it a lot. Did we talk about it?
No, like when we started the season, you talked about how it was really good and that the ED was bad.
Oh yeah, the ED is terrible.
Yeah,
and that's all you've said about it. So I know that there's time stopping and that's it.
Yeah, so the OP is really fucking good and the ED is really fucking bad.
What's bad about it?
So the show's about, like, they have a magic stone and it just stops time, and then over the episodes, they, like, learn how, like, the rules of the world, like, that they're trapped in, and, like, they gotta get out and they gotta, like, save the people who've been kidnapped, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. The ED, instead of doing anything related to any of that, just takes the main character and, like, draws her in really seductive and suggestive poses. And I learned shortly after the series started that it's because it's drawn by the guy who did Kite, and Kite is basically porn trying to disguise itself as an action series.
Mm. Yeah, it's a war photographer thing, but it's actually, like, every time I hear that premise, I'm like, oh, that sounds really good. And then I, like, look up online, they're like, no, this is a bad show.
Yeah, it's terrible. But yeah, the ED is drawn by that dude. So that's why it's bad.
I've referenced this before, but it will always remind me of the ED for Serial Experiments Lane, where it's just like, after a show about, like, self and, like, the depersonalization of the digital era, it's just like a naked 12-year-old lying in a pile of cables.
Yeah.
And, like, it's the ultimate example of, like, you're watching, like, an intellectual show and then your, like, mom or friend walks in while you're like, who? Are you watching porn? Like, no, it's...
This is real stuff, mom.
She's actually the internet. It's really complicated. You can't understand.
Well, then her being mostly porn, that makes sense.
It's really bad. But yeah, I like that show a lot. It's very slow and deliberately paced. They sometimes do some exposition, but it's only, like, it feels like it makes sense when it happens.
Yeah.
Like, it's characters explaining to other characters, like, how this shit works, because they actually know. And it's not like they're just talking out loud so that the viewers will know, you know what I mean? Mm. Like, it's contextualized within the setting, within the story. It's really fucking good. And it's not all revealed at once. It's revealed over time. They, like, learn things on their own through experimentation. It's a really solid show. I liked it a lot. The ending was pretty good. It also kind of, like, brought in this character, like, that just fucking saved the main character, and she had never showed up before. It was just kind of a deus ex machina, but it was still really good. It didn't ruin it for me by any stretch. I didn't even really dislike it that much. I kind of want it to lead into more stuff, but I don't know if it will. It was a pretty complete story. I liked it a lot.
You say she was a deus ex machina, and she was to an extent, but she was also in the second scene of the entire series, so They at least did some work in making a nice cyclical time loop by showing us the end of the series.
I don't feel it. I'm not feeling it.
I love that shit. Like, I was talking with Jeff about Nisi Monogatari and the fact that they, like, tease Nadako's closet in, like, the second or third episode of Nisi Monogatari and it doesn't pay off for a whole season. It's good.
Yep.
In this, it's smart because it reinforces the point that everything you've watched in the entire series has happened in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And its time hasn't been going on in the rest. So it's... John, how did you feel about the way they went with the main villain towards the end of the series, with him sort of getting a bit superpowery?
I was fine with it.
Okay. I was like, okay, he's getting a bit too, I have mastered this now, I have all the power.
I think it made sense because a lot of how, like, that world worked with the way the, what were they called, the tentacle things?
The heralds.
No. The heralds were the big spooky dudes. I'm talking about the things that actually go inside people.
I think they just called them the jellyfish the whole time.
That's it. That's it. Jellyfish. Yeah. The way that those things work, and speaking of heralds, the way that you turn into a herald, it's all about mindset, right? And I feel like that guy, like, accepted where he was and accepted what he wanted to be. So it made sense, like, how he gained control of that, because he wanted it, and he also knew exactly what he wanted. And he, you know, you could tell from the beginning that he was, like, in control of everything. He knew exactly what was going to happen and how it was going to happen. And like, as he experimented, he learned more and more and more. So I felt like it was fine. Yeah.
I haven't finished the series yet. I think I've gotten to, like, the 8th or 9th episode, but yeah, every episode felt like a really well-made, nutritious meal, whereas my monkey brain just wants garbage. And so, like, I never regretted watching it, but I was also never, like, hyped to watch it. And there, I had a couple of misgivings at the beginning because it does sort of, it takes a while to get going because they do spend a lot of time explaining the world, and they kind of have to, and it does pay off, which is nice. But I would recommend that people stick with the first, like, 5 or 6 episodes at least, and then you'll see why people think it's good.
I think that it was the most gripping show of last season. It was the only one that I kept up with week by week without any delays or any binges to have to catch up. I loved it. And I don't know if it was my favorite, but it was definitely up there for last season.
In a weird way, its treatment of fantasy sort of reminded me the way... It's like there isn't really a good word for sort of serious fantasy. Some fantasy which takes itself very seriously.
It was like a hard sci-fi kind of.
It was like hard sci-fi but fantasy, which was
it was like an approach, like the sort of approach hard sci-fi takes, but it was absolutely not hard science fiction.
It had rules and it made sure it outlined them and kept to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something I super appreciate in anime, because so often the rules are just off the walls and they don't bother to contextualize it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I love that show.
And like as you say, the one bit which bothered you was the main character escaping, because what seemed to be happening to her was like the logical end point. That was what we had all been told along was going to happen to her. And how she dealt with it was like, okay, this is the payoff and it's very sad, but that's what's going to happen. And I don't know whether you could say they bottled it a little bit instead of letting it play out tragically. But
I didn't necessarily want a tragic ending.
But there's no way that doesn't end tragic without that Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, she could have ended up going the way of the villain or not, like, turning into a bad guy, but you know what I mean? Like, embracing the world and trying to take control. But I don't think that would have worked either. I don't know. I don't necessarily want a tragic ending, but I wouldn't have been against it. I just didn't. This character coming out of nowhere and being like, oh, I'm the person responsible for all of this. then saving her was a little out there and didn't really fit with the, Jeff was saying, like, how everything had rules and stuck to it. Like, that kind of came out of nowhere. That's the only moment where I felt like, well, what? Okay, sure.
Cool. The other popular ones I know are
Laidback Camp or Yuru Camp Delta, whichever one you want to say.
Or Yuru Camp and then a tent shape with your hands.
Tent shape, yeah. It's so fucking comfortable, and I love camping, so I lived vicariously through it because I have not been camping for ages.
I love the article of all the, like, otaku who, like, decide to go camping because they watched Yuru Camp.
They're in for a surprise, though, because it ain't that easy. But, you know, whatever.
Camping ain't easy.
And the characters are so good, except for fucking Flesh Fang. She can die in a fire.
Oh, I love Flesh Fangs. I've come around. Rewatching the Monogatari series has like made me like, there's some good like drippy lip going on. So,
I want to throw up.
Yeah, the one in Eurocamp, she looks like Two-Face from the animated series with the weird like... the weird flesh bridge going from his like upper to lower lip.
Oh,
yeah, it ain't pretty. It ain't pretty at all. I don't. What? Why do people like whatever? I don't.
Is there a meta plot, or they just like go camping a bunch, and
they just go camping a bunch?
It's just their friendship developing, and Rin slowly being pulled into the group, and
yeah, because Rin's very much a solo camper to start.
Yeah, that was the kind of thing where I'm trying to keep the courage. Where if something's just not the show that I need right now, I'll just leave it alone and then watch it later, because I do like binging. So I'm gonna watch that in like 2020 probably. If 2020 is like really bad, like that'll be just the show, then I'll go camp for real. And
yeah, Eurocamp, fucking fantastic. It's another of my favorites. Let's go to A Place Further Than the Universe, aka Ice Girls. Very sad but also happy.
Mm-hmm. I think that was probably my show of the season last year, or at least the show of the season that actually came out during the season.
Last year? Or
of the last season. 2018. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty good. It's about some girls who go to Antarctica.
Mm. Have feelings.
Yeah, there's lots of feelings. They grow as friends. There's one of the girls, her mom was in Antarctica and died in Antarctica, and this is like about her trying to find closure by going there and visiting the place where she died, and also seeing the beauty of why she was willing to go there and risk her life. And it's very touching, and I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I know Andy fucking talked about how much he cried like every fucking episode. So.
Well, Andy cries at Violet Evergarden, so.
That's true. Oh my god.
That's the sad thing. We don't have Andy here to talk about Violet Evergarden.
I can talk about it.
Did you watch the whole thing?
I started watching it, and then I stopped watching it because it's garbage.
Let's talk a little bit more about Ice Girls rather than wasting time on Violet Evergarden.
Yeah, I think that's... yeah.
Y'all are making Andy cry right now. Cause...
Everything makes Andy cry. Now we make him cry.
Yeah, if you have anything to say about Ice Girls, I've pretty much said everything I got.
When I talked earlier about shows which I think should have ended one episode earlier, I think for me, Ice Girls was like the prime candidate.
Oh, wow. I actually thought it was ending on the episode where she reads the emails and just fucking starts bawling. I thought that was the end. And I was like, holy shit, they had the balls to do this. And I thought it was great.
That was me as well. I thought, wow. Wow, you've done this? You're ending on this? Yeah. Like, this
it was amazing.
Punch to the guts?
That was the climax of the show for sure. The rest of it was denouement, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man, I was so happy when it ended that way. I say happy, but I was crying.
Yeah.
That was a very sad moment.
Yeah, that was deeply affected.
I thought it was going to be the end, and I was like, holy shit, that's great. I did not imagine they would ever do that, but then there was one more episode where they just all they're fucking happy. So, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
I mean, it was generally very good. Decent amount of character development, well drawn.
The art was great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love there's a term for it, but like the highlights around the edges was really nice. I liked it. It gave it a very unique feel compared to a lot of anime.
Yeah.
Frosting? Mm. That's what I called it in Mario Galaxy. I don't know. Whatever.
The only thing I have to say about A Place Further Than the Universe is how badly the title is translated, because that's like my thing. Because it means like the literal meaning of the Japanese title is like Antarctica is farther away than space is from Japan. So that's like the idea. It's literally, I think the title is literally translated as like a place farther away than the sky. Which is beautiful and evocative, but doesn't translate well. So instead we have something that just kind of doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. I'll just say that.
I like the fact that the show was, like, it took a lot of tropes that you'd see in anime, a lot of, like, you know, like the friends and the power of friendship, and also just dumping that bucket of cold water over it. And the last episode is...
You might say a bucket of snow.
And you spit on my mic.
But it's very bittersweet. They, you know, one of the characters is like, why don't we stay here forever and be friends forever? And they're like, no, we got shit to do. Like, we'll still be friends and it'll be fine. But this is over now. And just and you had the one character, the idol, who's, I can't remember any of their names. But
yeah, I got nothing.
But she
bad is, with names.
But you know, she's been alone her whole life because her mom has been pushing her to be, you know, this TV star, And she keeps expecting to have all of the friendship confession and like the secret handshake and when she's going to learn all that. And her whole subplot is them explaining to her that like, it's not, you know, it's not codified like that. You know, you'll know, you know, when you're friends with somebody by the way you feel. And then also that's not a forever thing. Like people will grow apart and that's fine. Part of it is, in kind of the same way that Dragon Maid kind of touched on, that life is being present for and being receptive to the things that are happening around you and making the most of that. And that was something that was, I thought, a nice kind of pushback against, you know, like the heavily codified, heavily formulaic, you know, the power of friendship, the power of hard work, getting what you want story that is very common.
Okay, one of the most satisfying moments in the show for me was when that one of the girls had like dropped out of high school because she just fucking was tired of some shit from fellow high schoolers
getting bullied.
So I think she was in track and she was like bullied because she was underclassmen who ended up being on the starters or whatever, and some of her friends like betrayed her and started talking shit about her, and those friends, when they found out that she was in Antarctica, like sent an email, was like, oh, we're so sorry, we feel really bad for what we did. And then the god damn it, I wish I could remember the names, but the girl whose mom died in Antarctica, that's how she's defined, she gets real fucking pissed off at, you know, the girls who were bullying her friend and like goes off on them, and it was so fucking good. She was like, fuck you, get out of here. She never wants to see you again. I never want to see you again. Go away. It was great.
Is it Hinata or Shirase or Yuzuki or Mari Hinata, or Megumi?
Hinata is the one who was bullied and Shirase is the one who defended her.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. This show also looks good, but also was just something that I don't know. I've got a lot of shit to watch.
Yeah, well, you should watch the good stuff instead of whatever garbage you're watching.
Oh man, big word for someone who hasn't watched March Comes In Like a Lion all the way through.
Hey, listen.
It's a really depressing show, so you can't... Not always down to clown with March Comes In Like a Lion.
Yeah, I did the same thing after the second half, or, you know, for the second half of the first season. I was like, I don't want to do this right now. I'll watch it some other time, and then it was fucking great. So I'll watch this some other time, too. I'll continue down my list, which is not much longer.
Blow through that shit.
Yeah, so Dragon Ball Super already talked about. It was a good ending. It was Dragon Ball. What the fuck ever. Next up, Overlord. I think I'm the only person on the planet who actually likes the isekai genre when it's good, and Overlord's one of the really good ones. It's fucking... I love watching Ein's Urugaon be an evil fucking asshole who just wants to conquer the fucking world he's been sucked into. He's such a good villain, but he's also kind of an okay guy, but like not in the way that like he cares about humans and wants to save them, because there's several moments where he explicitly says, yeah, I don't give a shit about humans, and it's weird, but whatever, let's fucking kill him. It's great.
Are you excited for the third season?
Oh hell yeah, I am. Fuck yeah, I'm so happy. After the first season, I thought it was going to be done, but then they came back, and now they're going to do a third season.
They're not doing great disc sales, but they just keep making the anime. They must have a good licensing deal. That,
yeah, I don't know.
It's the pillow sales.
And it's Madhouse, so it looks pretty good. Ice Girls was also Madhouse, mm-hmm. and it looked great, too. They could not be more different.
Speaking of disc sales, Eurocamp's the big winner of last year.
Of course,
Last season. They made almost 13,000 a disc.
Yeah, that's some moe ass shit if there was ever moe, and you know what, whatever, it was good.
Actual winner for most disc sales last season is a surprise I'm going to talk about later.
I'm going to jump off a bridge. Okay, so that's all the ones that I actually finished. The ones that I stopped, let's start with Hakame to Mikochi. That's the one about the gnomes living in a world that's really cool. I didn't stop because I didn't like it anymore. I stopped because it was on High Dive and I kept forgetting to check High Dive, and then I fell behind, and then I didn't want to catch up because I didn't want to binge it all right now. I will eventually watch it though, because I really liked that world. I also started Junji Ito Collection and I stopped it because it was just not great. Whatever. I think it just isn't going to work in animated format, and it's kind of a shame. Like, if they put a lot of money and time into it, I'm sure it would be fantastic, but they just clearly do not have that money or time because it's an anime series and not a movie with years of development.
Mm-hmm. John, I've heard some people say that there were like odd episodes of that which really worked, but the majority just didn't. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there were some that I liked. I didn't like, I watched I think 5 episodes. I liked the first one because it was goofy as fuck and not at all like trying to be scary, and it worked. That character, I just call Curse Boy because I don't know any other name for him. He's just like, he tries to be super menacing, but it always just, he fails because it's so fucking stupid goofy, and he just doesn't know how to be an actual bad person. I mean, he is an asshole, but he's bad at it, and it's hilarious. As for the actual scary things, there was the one that I really liked. I don't remember the story, but there was one that I liked about, like, this, I think it was a woman who kept getting trapped in her dreams, and her dreams were lasting longer and longer and longer and longer, like, to the point where, like, an overnight dream was taking years in her head, and, like, that's a fucking horrifying idea, like, mm-hmm. that you would just be trapped for years inside your own head.
So the strength of that was that it wasn't a monster, it was just the concept. It had a really strong concept, and it sold that.
Exactly. Yep.
That's the best parts of
Junji Ito. Yep.
Like, the person-shaped holes in the mountain thing is just, like, an image that sticks with you rather than something that actually happens. It's just the fact that it exists out there, even fictionally, is...
Yeah, the world is normal, but there's one thing that's very wrong with it, and then everything just kind of spirals out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Ben, I've just had a mental image of Annihilation the anime.
I have Annihilation feelings that unfortunately are not appropriate for a podcast. So
I got two more things that I stopped watching. One was Mitsuboshi Colors, which was funny, but way too long. And then I stopped after the second episode because I just couldn't handle it.
Jeff, you were super into it.
I was, but then, like, I think in the third episode I had the exact same feeling as John and just kind of gave up on it.
Yeah, it would have been great as, like, a 15-minute thing with two skits, but instead it was a half hour, or, you know, 20-minute thing. I don't know.
And it was gross moe in the way that your camp was not.
Yeah, also there was a moment in, I think, episode 2 or 3 where it was, like, got a little fan servicey with one of the girls, and I was like, she's like 10, dude.
Yeah.
Chill.
It wasn't funny enough for me to push through that, so.
Yeah, the other show I had a problem with that, basically the same problem, was Takagi-san. The one where she's teasing the boy. Like, I really liked it, the first episode, a lot, and then the second episode just dragged on and also got a little weird.
Yeah, your fight with some other people on the internet about, like, is this male gazey or not, where there is, like, I watched just literally that, like, 5-minute chunk, and it was very bizarre how it cuts from a full body shot to a butt shot and back to a full body shot just to, like, know that she's putting her pants on her butt, which is not, like, or pulling her pants off her butt, which is just...
It was
anime.
I did not like that, but whatever. And then the last one that I stopped watching was Darling in the Franxx, because it's fucking bullshit. Now you guys can go into it and I'll just fucking cry or whatever.
I'm still watching Darling in the Franxx, but it's grudgingly pulled itself out of what I felt was an abject nosedive in terms of quality. But I know that that Jeff has big mood about Darling in the Franxx, so.
I have never claim that the show was anything other than fine, and I'm also doing my classic move of projecting a whole bunch of expectations onto it and just kind of waiting for it to disappoint me.
Like life.
A link to something we already discussed. It's almost the opposite in that Franxx doesn't really define its rules very well. It just sort of gives you an impression and then lets you sort of try and conjecture what the rules actually are, and that seems to be half the fun you and I are having with it.
Yeah. So I was looking at the Darling in the Franxx Wikipedia article, and there's all of these little things. So a general theme of the show...
Should we explain what Franxx is first before we go into it?
Sure. All right. So Darling in the Franxx...
Darling.
It's set in the distant future. Humanity exists within these big moving city domes, which are defended by big robots piloted by little kids who are paired up boy-girl because of sci-fi rules where the girl, like, hooks herself into the machine and then the guy drives the machine via the girl with weird, like, handlebars that come out of her butt.
Butt handles. They basically pantomime sex to pilot these robots, which is...
Yeah.
Fraught with meaning, I'm sure.
And there's, like, big monsters, and there's a lot of sort of general Evangelion overtones, which Ben insists is just blatant theft, and I think is something that they're doing on purpose to fuck with your expectations.
I mean, it can be both.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's definitely a post-Ava mecha show about kids. Like, I think that it's kind of a reversal.
As opposed to all those adult-focused mecha shows that we're blessed with beforehand.
Yeah. But like specifically like responding to the kind of scenario that they set up there, whereas like Evangelion was about a bunch of kids having mechs inflicted on them, and this show is about a bunch of weird sci-fi kids who are, you know, who are just, you know, they're raised from birth to pilot robots and have been put into this situation where they're actually being allowed to like have feelings and form relationships, which the show implies is something that is typically avoided. And there is a Dr. Franks, the guy who made the robots, is he kind of seems like a reverse Gendo, where he's like Gendo Akari from Evangelion, where, you know, instead of undermining the Illuminati, Seide, or whatever the hell they're called,
Zayla.
Yeah, he's like, you know, allowing them to feel feelings and all this other stuff. So I've completely lost the plot. One general big over theme of the show is like they use a lot of plant imagery and like plant words. Like the kids are referred to as pistils and stamens,
and collectively they're parasites.
Yeah,
like mistletoe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then mistletoe is the kissing weed, and kissing has given this weird sort of like mythological quality, because like, you know, like the act of procreation seems to have been basically actively removed from the human population. Like you get sort of a peek into the greater civilization, and the kinds of relationships that the kids are forming are just like completely vacant. Like people are paired up as a matter of tradition, but they basically just exist within the same house and follow their own interests and, you know, have sci-fi like VR soma to keep them happy, and it just are just kind of like these lifeless husks.
So let me go ahead and just like put my issues with Franks on the table. First off, it's paced terribly. You could cut half the episodes from the first season and not actually lose like literally anything from it. But moreover, I feel like I am uniquely positioned to dislike Franks because like 6 months ago, I soldiered my way through Eureka 7, which is very similar to Franks, I feel like, in a lot of ways. If you replace the plant imagery with music, especially hip-hop imagery, they're largely the same, like weird hybrid alien girl and like try hard boy get paired up in a ship that only works with them both together, and like piloting with her makes him sick, but they get over it, and there's adults who seem to have their own thing going on that's like vaguely abusive. I feel like the issue that I have with Franks is that the parts of it that I like are parts that are borrowed from other shows, and the parts of it that I find boring, tedious, or pretentious are the parts that it makes up for itself. I think that this is most typified in Zero Two, who for the first like four episodes was my favorite character by far, because she like had things that she wanted and pursued them. And before the most recent couple of episodes where she recovered her deleted memory, which is always a sign of a good anime or show in general, that they have deleted memories, she like got really flat and was all about like, I don't really like you, I just want to like become human. I don't know, like I do feel like Zero Two is like a mess of influences. She has, her color palette is largely Haruko Harahara from Fooly Cooly. Her style of dress is Nonon from Kill la Kill. Her face looks exactly like Anemone's face from Eureka 7. She talks like Lum from Urusei Yatsura, especially the da, darling, and she has fangs and horns. And her broad like role in the story is kind of an Asuka Rei from Evangelion blend thing. I like the idea of a grown-up Oni from folklore being in an adolescent anime and like preying on little boys who want to become more than they really are. But I feel like Franks is a mess of influences, and if it's going to succeed, it's going to succeed in spite of all the debts that it owes to Evangelion rather than because of them.
Okay, so you say that you liked her in the first few episodes where her drive was what set her apart.
Mm-hmm.
So what's another way we can describe drive? Well, desire. Zero Two is all about desire, as far as Franks is concerned.
Yes, I mean, that's the trope of the Oni, is they have huge appetites that are never able to be satisfied.
She's both the desire that's missing from the other characters, and also from our point of view, she's embodying all these women who are typically set up as objects of desire for the viewer. every character you've listed there probably has like 30,000 pages of deviant art drawn about them.
That's not a fair rubric by any means, though. But there's 30,000 pages of deviant art about Sonic the Hedgehog. So.
Within the fiction of the show, like, she is a hybrid of a human and the monsters that they're fighting, the Klaxosaurs, which I think is also sort of like a secret puzzle box that they're waiting to open.
Yeah, I'm tired of puzzle boxes, though. Aren't we done with that now? Like, can't we just have like stories about people? It's funny that I agree that there probably is stuff that I'm dismissing. And at this point, with the past two episodes, which have both like developed Heroes and Zero Two's characters immensely and in very positive directions in terms of how much I'm enjoying the show. But I do feel... I feel like there is just like a better story in there that I'm frustrated that Franks is not interested in accessing. And like the best episodes are the beach episode and the girls versus boys episode. The girls versus boys episode I would rate as like a 9 out of 10, while the Franks average for me is like a 5 or 6 out of 10. That one was like every character got to have their moment, and Ichigo and annoying yelly girl with pigtails, whoever she is.
Miku.
Yes, I guess. Like, everyone got to have their moment, and I feel like Franks is an ensemble cast that it largely is indifferent to, unless it's going to have, like, a cute little moment where one of them, like, learns some shit, and so...
Well, I mean, the first half of the first core, almost every one of those characters, or at least pairs of characters, got a focus episode and had a little bit of development. Part of the weakness of the show, or like just part of the nature of what it is that like all of the characters are in a lot of ways kind of objectionable because they've grown up in this crappy world. They're all kind of assholes to each other. They're all kind of like chafing against this role that's been placed on them. And each one of them gets to kind of exercise their demons in a way and grow a little bit and grow together. And like, and all the pairings are not also just becoming what all of the, like their relationships are going to be. And so there's a lot of like tension in there, but it's also not played up to like a very arch degree, which is kind of nice. A lot of the characters are kind of coded as being queer, and
especially the cutere girl, mm-hmm. glasses girl, who is hot like fire, but we'll leave that alone.
Goro, the glasses guy, who yeah. is paired up with Ichigo, who also is in love with Hiro, who, like, I mean, Hiro is literally the worst part of the show. He's just like this total like
good, yes,
total like Mary Sue potato coon, like any
everyone's friend potato coon, like believe in yourself, just tell me and we'll work it out together.
And when people are mad at him, it's always the result of a misunderstanding or some other thing that is completely out of his control. And like that's something that's actually kind of bumming me out about the more recent episodes, is that, you know, they were bringing Zero Two and Hiro together, but then there's a big just sort of injection of drama from the other characters, and now they've been split up, and I'm kind of worried that the rest of the show is just going to be them trying to reconnect, which is like not very interesting to me.
That's a lot for 12 episodes.
But that's the thing.
Didn't you just say, though, that you didn't like it that they were letting Hiro off easily, and yet those two recent episodes, he has this moment of connection with Zero Two, and what's his reward for it? He gets split up from her.
But again, like, it's never his fault. It's like he's always yeah. they're purposely keeping them apart, and then Zero Two, you know, has a heart-to-heart with Ichigo. They let her go back to her because, like, in the more recent episodes, they had a big connection. Zero Two almost kills him because her whole deal is that she wants to get back to this mystery kid that she had connected with back when she was small. Yeah. But then it turns out, of course, that Hiro was that kid all along, and now she feels all bad and guilty, and everybody hates her because she almost killed him in the process of trying to meet him again. And then, of course,
speaking of childhood promises as a yeah. as an annoyingly recurrent trope in anime,
and even in this show, like one of like the few bits of actual drama between the kids, like Hiro and Mitsuru, who's the like the very kind of arrogant, aloof kid. The reason he's kind of like that is because he had undergone this like extremely risky procedure when he was small, and Hiro had promised that, oh, you know, afterwards, you know, we're gonna work together. When he comes back and recovers, like Hiro has no memory of this, and so he's like, oh, you're fluffing us up for your own good, like you don't actually give a shit about us. But of course, it's actually because Hiro had this whole adventure with Baby Zero Two, who he also just happens to have named like he's named everybody else. Also, there's okay, my trait of hating decent puns is that...
Oh no, it's good. It's so good.
She is called Zero Two. She always refers to herself as Zero Two, and everybody has a name that is kind of made out of... Because everybody has code names and like...
A three-digit code name, yeah.
And he's been naming everybody based on their code name. So Ichigo is like 016. Goro is 056.
These are numbers in Japanese.
Goro. But 02 is 02. But his first thing that he comes up with is Oni, which is, you know, Oni, and she's like red and she has horns and she's this like total Oni character. And as soon as she said it, I was like, fuck you. And I just like, it just announced to the world, like, actually, Franks is bad. I'm wrong.
No, it's good. That was like the one moment I connected with. Because like the fact that they don't like acknowledge that, I wish that some of you, I would not wish watching Urusei Yatsura on anyone, but like 02's character, like her behavior and her like attitude, pre like I need to become human, that like weird obsession was just Lum from Urusei Yatsura. And so there's like a very gentle but irresistible call out to the old nerds in the audience about like this like predatory, sexually liberated, extremely affectionate Oni girl who just falls into your life. And I like, that's been something that's really, it gave me a lot of goodwill towards 02. And then as she's kind of stalled because I don't know, because Hiro needs to save her with his boy feelings.
And to jump back into like the big high concept of the show, like the futuristic society is this completely sexless, technologically driven society. The Dr. Franks guy is injecting, you know, these human feelings back into it. And looking at the Wikipedia page, I now realize that his organization is literally called APE. And and that's the, and like his whole deal is I'm putting feelings back into these kids to give them more power, which is something that is, you know, it's something that like the whole society is trying to exercise. And I suspect that the big monsters that they're facing are kind of part of that. And that's why 02 is half human, half monster and blah, 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 blah. Like, I think they're doing something with it. Like the fact that Dr. Franks is also like a lecherous creepazoid, and it doesn't really seem like it's just that, you know, the elites are secretly all assholes. It's like him specifically has this Gendo Akari-esque ulterior motive that he's pursuing,
as opposed to all the well-adjusted mad scientists in anime.
Yeah,
but no, I agree. But like also your callback to like this like society that's been de-emotionalized and desexualized is, I mean, you did kind of reference Brave New World with Soma, and there is kind of this idea that like there is a segment of the society that has to get into these annoyingly magical girl stylized mechs that I hate. Oh, I roll my eyes so much when I see the mechs, but they have to like,
they're fine.
Kids. No, they're bad. Kids have to have emotions and have to have sexual feels so they can get in these robots and fight magma demons so that the rest of society can like have these weirdly anodyne lifestyles where they don't get married, but they do like live together with someone else from the opposite sex. Which, if we can't leave off Franks without saying like how disappointingly heteronormative it is. And
yeah,
if it subverts that, that's great. But as of right now, 14 episodes in, sex and relationships are between a man and a woman unequivocally. And that's not surprising from traditionalist Japan, but kind of a bummer when it's a great opportunity to just like, what was your thing about 02 like represents like radical feminine independence or something?
Yeah. Part of the thing in the show is like, and it's also the thing that kind of gives me hope, is that both the elites that run the society and also Dr. Franks are both presented as at least being sort of assholes and sort of evil and sort of the kind of thing that the kids are eventually going to buck against. The fact that the whole thing with the guys and the girls, I suspect that Dr. Franks is on some like Jordan Peterson bullshit where the women are these like creatures of chaos and the men have to be in control of them, because like the whole thing with the robots is that the girls drive the robots, but the guys drive the girls, like, and it's for their own safety. And they can drive them by themselves, but they go into this like stampede mode and it's supposed to be very dangerous. And so like a man has to be the one who is controlling them ultimately. But this is all the result of this Dr. Franks guy, who's a woman hating asshole. Like, they, you know, those robots are designed by his specifications and he's an asshole. And part of the thing with 02 is that she is the one most capable of doing this on her own, and she kind of like, instead of her being controlled by the guys, she consumes them and kills them in her pursuits. And so like, it seems like the show is kind of threatening to go in that direction, and that might just be me projecting onto it. And like, so far the show has done nothing for me to like really earn that beyond problemizing the elites of this society. So I'm probably going to be deeply disappointed by that.
My feeling is that, and this is to steal a march from Austin Walker of Waypoint, but like, I feel like Frank's strongly gestures in a lot of directions, and I don't feel sure which of those gestures is actually a movement towards a certain theme or certain topic. And I'm not optimistic because, again, I'm still fresh off how much I did not like Eureka 7 and how how much of my time Eureka 7 wasted in service of these completely vapid, empty themes. But, I mean, worst comes to worst, Frank's is good, and I have to eat crow on this podcast in a couple of months, and I'm okay with that, honestly.
It won't happen.
Unless you guys have other feelings. Like, I'm like getting into my like fan theory bullshit, which I kind of want to avoid. Like, I definitely want to talk about the show again when it's over, but I don't think I have really much more to say about it now.
I mean, every episode is so, thus far, except for the last two, every episode's been so different and so like, oh, is the show about this now? Like, oh, or they're not pursuing that now. Like, they gave the fat guy who always has food and questions if he can eat everything. They gave him like a very pathos-filled episode. And next episode, nope, he's done. Like, that was his moment.
I think you have a point there. I think in a way, you saying that actually reminds me of some of the problems I have with Violet Evergarden. In that, I think, as you say, everyone has their episode. They each have their little moments, but those moments never sort of intermingle. There's no sort of messiness to it. It's, oh, here's his episode, and this happens, and he has his little bit of emotional growth, and it doesn't really affect anyone but him. Next time, next person.
I would kind of push back against that. I think as each character gets their moments, I think more and more mess is being introduced into the show, and a lot of it is kind of contained in sort of like meaningful looks from people, and they haven't really come to like a lot of conflict within the characters, but I feel like they are building up something to pay off. But again, maybe I'll just be disappointed.
I mean, anything is possible, so yeah. Well, let's go ahead and go through the new season.
Yeah, it's time for the good shit.
I'm watching Golden Kamuy. Despite the bear and the wolf being really crappy, this is as good as John led me to believe it is.
Hell yeah. You'll like it a lot once it gets going, though.
Both characters are well-defined. They have very obvious goals. This is the thing that I'm really into right now. It's just like characters who want things and pursue them. And the way that you make me hate a character is by them not wanting something or not going after it. And the fact that, like, dude who fought in the, like, Russo-Japanese War and was like known as Immortal Sugimoto meeting up with some like badass Ainu chick, and they're gonna go find some gold that was stolen from her father. Like, it's good. I was just like there the whole time. Mm-hmm. Fight me here. I like the bears kinda. Did you like the bears?
I thought the bears were way better in motion than they were in screenshot.
Yes,
they were kind of like monstrous. I still like wish it was just animated, but like 2D, but it wasn't as bad as I thought it was gonna be. I'll admit that.
They are realistic bears, so like there's this realistic object intruding into an animated space, and that was really good for me. And then what made me double down that opinion was when the wolf came in, who is super anime and just looks like something bad from like Wind Waker or something. Like, I don't know, like it like had like a really obvious cel shaded look, and the way that it moved was very like poser 3D art. I don't know, but the show is great. Like the plot itself is great.
Yeah, it gets really fucking good. Just, man, wait until they start getting into the cooking shit. I'm so excited.
Oh yeah, I forgot that's a food anime and not like a western style find the lost gold anime.
It's all of it.
I want to read the manga. I think
manga's really good.
Well, apparently the anime is moving fast because it's like the first two or three chapters is the first episode, so that's like hitting it hard.
Yeah, I can't remember, but yeah, it's a pretty good adaptation. It's pretty also like by the books, but it works a lot better than, say, Angelmagus' Bride did, where it was just like, that's a slow-paced manga in the first place, and you can't just fucking be slow anime too when you're not going to do anything special. But anyway, yeah, Golden Kamuy's great. I'm happy with the first episode.
I'm watching Sword Art Online Alternative, Gungale Online.
Yo, it's really good.
Are you trolling me?
No, I watched the first episode. I thought it was great.
No, okay, good. Because, like, I really liked it. And then, like, everyone's like, oh, you like a Sword Art Online anime? And then, like, I...
Well, that, of course that's going to be my reaction. Sword Art fucking Online.
Am I right that, like, in the first 5 minutes, they're like, this has nothing to do with Sword Art Online?
Yeah, just... it's like, it's aggressively not that anymore.
I honestly don't even know why they have the... I mean, I do. It's for marketing reasons. Yeah. But
I really liked the way they did the death tags. Like, they were almost comedy. And that was, like, to reinforce it. Like, the entire meme and... thing people will take the piss out of Sword Art Online is you die in the game, you die for real.
Yeah.
And yet in this, it's just someone dies and this little dead icon pops up with like a dead face or on it or something.
It throws you right into the middle of this very tense battle royale where like you have the viewpoint character who's this girl, this tiny cute girl in pink, wielding a pink P90
named P-Chan
and like a rabbit ear hat.
She has a good hat.
And then like has like a super like bulky like kind of like serious face dude who's like carrying a massive backpack and has a massive sniper rifle, and he just like walks you through the stakes of the episode, and it's really good. I mean, like, I know that I'm vulnerable to like guns but like this is, I mean, it's good that like you guys liked it because it's not just me.
No, it's actually really entertaining.
Yeah. And also like the game that they're playing obviously borrows very heavily from PlayerUnknown's Battleground, which is just an inherently good way to like generate drama. And it's also not like the whole show is just revolving them doing this one long instance of the game, so it moves very quickly.
Yeah, no, it's, have you guys watched the second episode yet?
No, I've only seen the first one.
I haven't gotten to it.
It's mostly like how she gets into the game, and like the reveal at the end is that she's like the super tall girl, and the,
she's like a teacher or something, right?
No, I was wrong about that. She she like goes to college, but like she's like 6'6", and so like she hates how tall she is, and so the way that Sword Art Online works is, or the online games in this world work, is that you have a randomly rolled physical attributes for every character, and so she just kept rolling a character until she found who's small. And it was in this like super hardcore shooter game, and she's like, okay, well, I guess I'm learning this because I get to be 4'8" and like,
you get to be small,
a cute little girl.
That's funny.
And then she's like, I'm not cute enough, and so she gets like pink outfits to like make her like super cute.
Yeah,
it's good. I mean, it's like they introduce a bunch of characters, and honestly I prefer the rules part of the first episode more than like learning about who Len, L-L-E-N-N,
yeah,
who her name is Karen in real life, but like who she is, she's fine. But like, I don't know, it's nice. It's going to be just 12 episodes of hopefully some like good drama. It's written by the Kino's Journey guy, who has a deep affection for guns that's definitely showing here. Because in the second episode, they like go to like a gun store, and just like she meets a girl who's like, I really love guns and I'm super rich, so I buy all the guns. And then they just talk about guns for like 4 minutes, and I'm just like, yes, yes, it's the M. Bison clip. Yes. Give me cartoon girls talking about firearms in a fictional setting, please.
And I gotta say, using the last half of your first name as your screen name is, that's a good move. I approve of that.
Yeah, it's good. I hope it goes somewhere. If it doesn't, it's gonna be a gun anime that I can recommend instead of Upute, so I'm fine with that. And on the other end of the spectrum, I'm kind of digging Wotoko ni Koi wa Muzukashi, also called Wotokoi. It's about a office lady who's super into like nerd shit, and she moves to a new office and meets like an old schoolmate who's also into nerd shit, and they start dating.
And they start dating it. Like, I'm going back to like me playing myself, like I was super blueballed by MMO Junkie because I thought it was going to be actually about her having a relationship, whereas the whole thing was just a big 13 episode meet cute. Whereas this seems like it's picking up where that show left off. So I have high hopes.
I think we mentioned this in a very early episode. If you want anime about people actually in a relationship versus them being on the verge of a relationship, you've got to,
if you say it,
you got to walk a mile, because it's like Kare Kano, Ore Monogatari, a bunch of question marks, and now this, I guess.
Yeah, and like, yeah, actually, like in the rapidity of the relationship, you know, or like at least the proposed relationship between Hiro and O2 was kind of something that interested me early about Franks. Something that has kind of driven my interest in Monogatari. I'm in this mode right now of people having relationships in anime that I'm just kind of obsessed with. So I have high hopes.
Please watch Karakana.
Yes, I think that was the second thing that I looked into after I like met up with you guys and like just never got around to it. And now I promise you, Ben, I will watch that show and we will talk about it.
I think you're going to be disappointed, not by Karakana, but by Wataki, because I just don't. I think they're setting them up to be the super shy couple who are technically dating, but all they do is hold hands and they never kiss.
Oh, I've seen some screenshots from the manga, and there's an exchange, and it's like, hey, do you want to go out tonight? And she's like, yeah. It's like, why don't you come over to my place? And she's just like trying to remember what color underwear she's wearing. So it's like,
oh,
it seems like maybe they're going to be doing some stuff.
So this studio's A1 Pictures, but that's how they were able to have Saikano and Monster Hunter, because they're like part of a big production group, so they can have all these like direct references to actual anime and video games. Mm-hmm. But it's directed by the guy who directed Working.
Oh, now I'm interested. Well, I'll watch it.
The thing that actually bums me out the most is that the art is not great. They have very generic, kind of lanky, clamp adjacent character designs that don't really appeal to me.
Now I'm not going to watch it.
I wouldn't even go that far, because Clamp at least has an aesthetic, whereas this show is so bland. And like,
they're all, yeah, it's not good art. And the voice performances I like, but they're off-putting kind of in a weird way.
Yeah, they're really idiosyncratic.
And you've anti-sold me.
Well, we'll come back again. Don't worry about it.
Are you sure that part of this is just that you think they look lanky because 90% of the characters we see on screen are actually teenagers? And so they actually start throwing adults, and you're like, oh, these strange, normal-sized people.
I don't know. They're taller than, like, the shelves around them, so I don't know. I think also just, like, the colors are kind of flat. Like, I hate that I'm the kind of person who's like, oh, I don't know if I like this anime, because it needs more, like, the colors need to pop more, and, like, the vocal performance needs to be more distinctive. It's fine. But, like, the prospect of the plot itself is super. And directed by the Working guy, who knows how to, like, set up good comedy. And there was, like, I mean, I didn't laugh at, like, when they went to the bar the two times, her and her school friend who she ends up dating, they have a good dynamic. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm fine to watch it. And tall, sexy, former cosplayer lady is played by Sawashiro Miyuki, and she's great. She's a Kanbaru.
Now I'm in.
And Maria from Arakawa Under the Bridge, John.
Oh, shit, I'm in again. You got me.
No, she's great. She's great. She's also in Mariaholic, so that's, like, I mean, there's going to be some B-roll of me gushing about how good the cast is on Mariaholic and how tempted I am.
Who was the actress?
Sawashiro Miyuki. She's the dorm mistress in Mariaholic.
Ah, okay.
No, she's great. She's been around forever, and she puts in good work. So she's Taro in Sino Setsuba Sensei. She's good. Good stuff. Good anime for people.
All right. Should I start my stupid list?
Knock us out.
Okay. Lupin Third Part 5 is really great because it's more Lupin. Also, it's weirdly like super high tech, unlike previous stuff. Like, I mean, the last season, Part 4, had crazy VR dream stuff, which is weird. But that was great. But the first episode of Part 5 starts with the gang trying to steal a bunch of Bitcoin from Silk Road, which is fucking great.
That's super like relevant, so
yeah. Like, it's crazy. And then like, I think the second half of that episode, the guys that they stole Bitcoin from like start this social network to just track Lupin the Third everywhere he goes. So everybody's like tracking him with their phones, and like they know where he is at all times to help the cops catch him, because I mean they want that to happen. And then Lupin finds a way to get around that by just always showing where he is and showing off so people get bored of it, which is fucking on point with the internet. And then they hire some assassins, of course, and they're following him around with drones and shit, like keeping track of where he is at all times. It's just so good. Like, I really like how they're embracing tech, and like it's sort of like near future sort of tech. Like, he's got crazy hacking monocle thing, which is
Google Glass.
Yeah.
What did you think of the villains, the assassins in the latest episode?
They're so fucking goofy. Lupin, I love it. One of them's fighting with a fucking fishing pole. Come on, yes.
and not with the pole itself, with a lead weight on the end, which he sort of whips around.
Oh, it's so good. Oh, man. It's goofy. I love it. I love Lupin, all its flaws, and you know, whatever. It's great. I am disappointed they didn't change the color of his jacket, because this is part 5. Explicitly part 5. They always change the color of his jacket for a new part.
Chill out, Patrick.
No, it's green, red, pink, blue, and what's next? I don't know. They're running out of colors.
In the very start of it, they did have a clip from him in each jacket, and so
yeah,
maybe he'll pick up a new jacket.
Oh, maybe he will. That would be good. Mm. What would it be, though? Yellow?
Yeah, yellow jacket.
Mm.
Brown.
Brown, no. That's Zenigata. Zenigata's brown, always brown.
Let's move on. Let's move on, please.
What? Hold on.
Corduroy
you
jacket.
You need to watch Lupin. It's so good.
Listeners, help. Help save me. Please do something.
Okay, Megalobox. It's good. It looks fucking ugly. Why do they have this shitty fucking filter / downscaling, upscaling strategy? God damn it, it's bad. I hate it.
It's to make it look old.
I don't care. I hate them. Anyway, that's going to be the anime that people are like, oh, this is one of the good anime for people who don't like anime. I can already tell.
Yeah, like all the other ones from the early 2000s that this show is supposed to look like.
It's good. I don't dislike it at all. I'm frustrated by their stupid fucking filter strategy bullshit, but it's good. I will keep watching.
That honestly doesn't detract from its strong points to me.
100% it does.
The parts which make it a good show to me aren't that affected by it.
But it has such a, like, I say unique style, but it's more like embracing the older style of art, but then it fucking ruins it by also embracing the low-res style of those older shows.
Well, as that one tweet that I showed you guys pointed out, like, Ashita no Joe, which Megalobox is based on, or, like, a revival of,
yeah,
like, it's actually really sharp and crisp. It's, yeah, like, based on someone's crappy VHS or DVD copy of the show that's been, like, downscaled or poorly compressed. It's, like, literally someone's fake memory of how the show looks.
So what you're saying is this is the Force Awakens of anime. It's based on people's memories of what a film was like and reliving them rather than what actually the original was about.
We don't talk about Star Trek on this podcast. Sorry. Yeah. My favorite thing about Megalobox so far is the quote from the guy who's responsible for this travesty, who has like a weird nostalgia for the Cell animation style, but never actually did it. So he's just trying to emulate his shitty VHS tapes. And Ben said, stupid. Anyway, moving on.
Yes, please.
Magical girl site. Bad. Torture porn. I don't know. I thought it was going to be some cheesy ass magical girl action shit. Instead, it's like they took Madoka's torture porn and turned it up to 1,000. And it's really, oh man, it is sadistic against that main character. Ooh, I might watch episode 2 because I want to see if it gets cathartic.
There was someone on the staff for that who was notable. I can't think who it was now.
I have no idea. Yeah, that's a show. Tana never falls in love.
That's a good show.
Very cute. I liked it a lot. I loved the first episode. The second episode, I wish that Photography Club president did not exist because I'm not into the whole, I love Gravura idols. I know their cup size by looking at their chests. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Am I wrong, or are they hinting that the class president is the idol?
It seemed like that, but I think it's more likely that it just was hinting at the fact that she's got a huge crush on it.
Okay.
Yeah. While he was talking about the idol, like, she was blushing because she was like, oh, but I really like you. Please stop talking about her.
I don't know. I thought that she glanced up at it, and who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, she doesn't have a big enough cup size. Anyway, Space Battleship Tiramisu. Fucking hilarious. It's a short thing. It's like 5 minutes, right, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's super great. 2 skits every episode. It's fucking hilarious. I highly recommend it. It's just like this dude who is a really good mech fighter in space, but he just wants to eat his food. He just wants to have a pet. He just wants to, like, feel comfortable in his clothes, but he's always being rushed. And he puts on his shirt backwards, and then he tears it off in the middle of the fight and is nude. It's so good. I highly recommend that one.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, Hinamatsuri. Fucking hilarious. Really good comedic timing. It's about this girl who, like, this alien or psychic-powered girl who crash lands in this gangster's apartment, and it's fucking, like, he turns into basically a dad just taking care of her, because if he doesn't, she's gonna wreck his life with her crazy psychic powers, and then they, like, grow to like each other. It's charming, and it's really funny. Like, the comedic timing is fantastic.
The voice acting is also really good.
Oh, yeah. The Hina, the girl, her voice is so good. And I like the guy, too, yeah. But the Hina, I feel like they really fucking nailed that cast.
Mm.
Highly recommend that one. My Hero Academia Season 3, really boring recap episode. Whatever. It's going to be more My Hero Academia. They're going into a good arc. Gurazini, this one is probably the biggest surprise for me. It's a baseball anime, but the main character is just like super obsessed with like his salary and just trying to make a lot of money to retire peacefully. He's making a lot of money, so I feel like he could just do that if he just invested smartly. He's obsessed with everybody's salary. That's how they like rate each other, like how skilled somebody is. Apparently it was not well received, but I thought the first episode was great. I haven't watched the second episode yet. I'm looking forward to seeing more characters and how they interact. Caligula, I just watched because it was there. And it started out with like this pretentious ass dude who was just like going on about some basic ass philosophy just nonstop. And I thought it was going to be some like pretentious trash that I could enjoy. But then it turned into this weird action thing at the end. So I don't know. Like, he's living in this fake world created by an AI idol to try to save humanity or something, because they're all miserable and she just wants to put them in this simulation so they're never miserable. It's weird. And that's it.
Cool. It's a full season. I think we were talking earlier about how this season was going to be kind of like barren.
I
mean, there's a lot of stuff to get excited for. You didn't even mention Steins Gate Zero.
I haven't watched it yet. Yeah, that's right. I haven't watched that. I did start the first episode of Food Wars, and as usual, the first episode bored me to tears, so I stopped halfway through. I do intend to watch Cutie Honey. I want to watch Watakoi. I haven't watched the new Full Metal Panic because I still haven't finished the second raid. And there's also Major Second. That's apparently a popular baseball anime, but I don't know. Is this like a sequel?
Yeah.
Because it's Major Second?
Major is the first one. It's like 48 episodes or something.
And I don't know if it's worth watching this or worth watching the first one before I start this. I don't know.
I think it's like a big serialized plot. So, oh, huh. Oh, no, it's the sun. So there are like, there's six seasons of Major totaling like 150 episodes.
Oh boy.
And then Major Second is the son of the protagonist of the first Major.
So it might work out as an okay, just like starting point. I might give it a shot. It's a sports thing.
Yeah, watching 150 episodes is a big ask. So
yeah,
more than that actually. Wow.
But yeah, that's me. I'm done.
I was going to talk about Girls in Panzer, but I think the new movie, but I think we've gone long enough. So let's take a break.
I will briefly, very briefly, I'm sorry, I just want to say this. Kakegurui is not great, but I do think that my theory is that it's a very expensive fetish club. And it's not actually a high school at all.
Well, it is as much a high school as the high school in Kill la Kill is. I think it's just, you know, it was an aesthetic that they adopted so that they could do extended Darby the Gambler homages of just a bunch of people getting really horny off of high stakes gambling.
This is Kakegurui again, an anime about like gambling. Like there's like
gambling and sex, yeah. But like not real sex, but like sexy gambling. You know what I mean? Like
like strip poker.
Yeah, like people getting droolingly horny off of high stakes gambling and like selling themselves into slavery, and
like you do.
Having your fingernails ripped off is like the stakes of the second episode, and it kind of escalates from there.
Yeah. This is not a new anime, by the way. This is just something that like Jeff got super into while he was traveling abroad and brought back as like a disease.
You're next, Ben.
No.
Yeah, it was on Netflix and I just kind of power watched it while I was like freaked out from traveling and recovering from jet lag.
Yeah, it had been on my list for a while and Jeff talking about it just made me watch it. It's, you know, it is what it is. I enjoyed it. Like, it's not great. I would never recommend it to anybody.
No.
What did you enjoy? The drama or the art or the action?
I enjoyed the fucking over-the-top bullshit. Sometimes I like some trash and this was trash that I liked.
Yeah, and yeah, like I compared it to Darby the Gambler from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, which like I'm kind of a big JoJo's guy and that's like my favorite part of that show, where the stakes are so high but the actual action is people trying to cheat at parlor games, and that contrast, it works really well for me as like sort of black comedy.
If you want an actual good gambling anime, watch Kaiji.
or Akagi.
Akagi is good too. I like Kaiji a lot more because it's not just what are they even fucking playing in Akagi.
Isn't it a mahjong or something?
Might be, yeah. But Kaiji is actually really good. Also, you'd like it, Jeff. Don't fucking sleep on it. I'll scream. Anyway, done. Okay, that's all I got.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break now that we've covered two seasons worth of anime, basically, and come back to handle our spotlight pitches for next episode.
Oh yeah, it's the spotlight time.
Okay, going through Sawashiro Miyuki, she was Kurapika in Hunter x Hunter. She's Fujiko Mine in Lupin.
Mm-hmm.
She's Inaba in Kokoro Connect. She's Ayana Yano in Kimi ni Todoke. She's Tsugumi Aoba in Kanagi. She's Kirai Momobami in Kakagurui, main antagonist of the series. She's Y in Humanity Has Declined, the one who likes cars and has a boy love printing press.
Oh, nice.
She's Kelty in Durarara. She's Maria in Arakawa Under the Bridge. She's Wakako in Wakakazake. She's Tico Science in Diebuster.
So she's a lot.
She's Sonora in C-3BOO. She's Rita in Shigeki no Bahamut.
Mm-hmm.
She's Ginkgo's child voice in Mushishi. She's like everything. She's the best. She might be my favorite voice actress I don't even know about. She's Maria in Sanazetsubou Sensei. She's Vivian in Kekkai Sensen. She's like in everything. And she's like a million years old, but not really. She's actually my age. And we're back. For the second half of the podcast, we will be doing spotlight pitches to John, who pitched our last anime, Hinotori.
Hi, yeah.
Jeff, would you like to go first?
Sure. My pitch is when I first joined this illustrious podcast, I was just getting into Gunbuster. And then in our various talking about Frank's Diebuster came up, and I watched that kind of in parallel with getting caught up with Frank's. So my pitch is the two compilation movies that were cut together, Gunbuster versus Diebuster. I think, you know, individually they're good. And within context of one another, I think they're interesting because they're both Gainax joints. Hideaki Anno kicked off Gunbuster, and I kind of read it as a proto Evangelion, whereas Diebuster sort of exists very much in the post-Eva world where, you know, in Anno's view, people kind of like took the wrong ideas from his show and just kind of doubled down on all the things that he hates. And to my knowledge, I don't think he really had anything to do with Diebuster other than helping to recut it for...
It's the Fooly Cooly guy.
Yeah, and it's the Fooly Cooly guy. Like, on its own, it's very interesting. Like, I think Diebuster is good, but it's also bad in all the ways that Anno hates, and I think it's that makes it interesting. So that is my pitch.
Tsurumaki Kazuya is the guy.
Yeah.
I am also pitching a anime movie. As you all know, Isao Takahata, the other half of Studio Ghibli with Hayao Miyazaki, he passed away recently. And there's been a lot of weirdness online with people who don't really know his role in things. And I think we should watch The Tale of Princess Kaguya. It's his best work by far. It's a beautiful movie. I took it as a sign that when someone wrote into us last full episode to ask about the best music in anime, Kaguya came to mind immediately. It has a completely unique art style. It is a rich, compassionate, subtle story of growing up and letting go and what we think we want from this life and what we get from it. And it is Takahata's masterpiece that was a critical success, but an abject commercial failure.
Really?
It did not break even by a long shot. And yeah, I would like to discuss it again because I saw it in theaters and I saw it again when I bought the Blu-ray. And it's a rewarding experience every time. And if you haven't seen it, you should watch it. And if you have seen it, you should watch it again. Because at this point, you're at a different point in life than when you watched it before. And it'll give you more this time, too.
You're good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Duncan.
What he said. It's a good job I went last, really. Saved me a lot of trouble.
You're also pitching The Tale of Princess Kaguya?
Mm-hmm.
I should have gone for Only Yesterday then. Let's go ahead and put Only Yesterday on the table too, because that's also Takahata's masterpiece then. Another one of his masterpieces. About a 20-something woman who feels unfulfilled and disconnected from her family and life, going home to a rural area and also having memories of growing up as a child. And the challenges of growing up in the latter half of the 20th century.
Alrighty. Interesting. That's hasn't happened.
I knew that Duncan would pitch. If Duncan's going to pitch any Takahata, he was going to pitch Kaguya, so I should have anticipated and pitched Only Yesterday. But
I thought of contacting you beforehand and saying, are you going to pitch that? But nah, too much organization.
We'll do that. We'll do that next time. But yeah, it's going to be a movie no matter what.
I guess I got a pick now, huh? I am going to go with Kaguya.
Woo!
Nice.
Has everyone here seen it?
Nope.
I have not, and I like the art style, so I want to see it.
Wonderful. I can't wait to talk about it.
I have seen Gunbuster and Divebuster before. Unfortunately, not a huge fan of it.
No, I've just realized I've truly messed this up, because technically, who's the next person pitched to?
I'll go ahead and change mine to I pitched only yesterday, Duncan. You can go ahead.
You went first, so.
I'm picking Gunbuster, so we avoid.
Duncan, I pitched only yesterday. You pitched Kaguya, so you get to choose next time.
All right, the regime begins.
Cool, wonderful. Okay, thanks for listening to this probably jumbo size episode. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Email us questions at keyframespodcast@gmail.com or message us on Twitter at keyframespod. Find us on Facebook at keyframespodcast. And most of all, tell a friend about us and about anime. Say goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Seriously?